Hey, you're listening to Opinion Science, the show about our opinions, where they come from, and how they change. I'm Andy Luttrell. If you've been following this show, you know that a couple weeks ago, I released a big five-part series on an idea in social science called behavioral economics. Very quickly, a long time ago, economists were making this wild assumption that people must make decisions rationally. That assumption was baked into their theories about how the economy works. Then, a ragtag group of economists and psychologists were like, that can't be right, and they provided a bunch of data to prove it. Yada, yada, yada. Now social scientists have identified tons of biases in human decision-making, and this view has become mainstream. I'm glossing over basically everything, so go back and listen to that if you haven't already. It was produced in collaboration with my buddies at the podcast Behavioral Grooves, and we're super proud of it. I've been blown away by the feedback, so thank you to everyone who's already reached out. And if you haven't reached out, I'd love to hear from you. Find me on opinionsciencepodcast.com and let me know what you thought of the series. But we interviewed around 20 people for that series, and only a sliver of those conversations made it into the final set of episodes. But there were a couple of interviews that I did anyway that I thought were super insightful in their own right and went beyond the story of behavioral economics that we were trying to tell. And I'll be releasing those as their own episodes of Opinion Science. They'll be a little more raw than a typical episode of this show, but I think you'll get a lot out of them. And the first one of these episodes is happening right now. Welcome to it. I'm excited to share my conversation with Sendhil Mullanathan. He's a professor of computation and behavioral science at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. He received a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2002. He co-founded a nonprofit called Ideas 42 to apply behavioral science. He's studied poverty and discrimination and artificial intelligence. But before all that, he was an undergraduate student of Richard Thaler's at Cornell, and then a PhD student in economics at Harvard when he attended the very first Summer Institute of Behavioral Economics in the mid-90s. So anyhow, I set up this interview mostly because I wanted to get Sendhil's experience as a student when this field of behavioral economics was blossoming. But it turned out that he also had interesting ideas about all sorts of things. We started out talking about this class he was teaching on artificial intelligence. And for context, this conversation happened in February 2022, more than 2 years ago. AI seems like a totally different thing now, just 2 years later. But we also talked more broadly about social science, and then, and I didn't realize this until I was prepping to talk with him, but he was part of this really important study on racial discrimination, which was published in 2003. We'll talk more about it, but the gist is that they fabricated a bunch of resumes and sent them in to a bunch of real job openings. They systematically varied things in those resumes, like whether the applicant's name conveyed male or female identity or a particular racial identity. And then they took stock of which resumes prompted companies to try to schedule an actual interview. Spoiler alert, names that conveyed white identity, like Emily or Greg, fared significantly better than names conveying black identity, like Lakeisha or Jamal. But there are a bunch of other notable findings in that study, too. So at the end of our conversation, I get Sendhil to talk more about how they did that study and what the findings meant. For me, this is like a central study in a class that I teach on the psychology of prejudice. And so it was really great to get to talk to one of the people in the room when this study was actually going on. Okay, so that's the plan. Sound good? Okay, great. Here we go. As you'll hear, it was a rare evening recording. I remember I was like really rushing home, and I think it was raining really hard, but I was like, I gotta get back home before 7 o'clock so I can talk to Sendhil Mullanathan. And so here we are, more than 2 years later, my conversation with Sendhil Mullanathan. So yeah, so this is, thanks for taking the time in the evening to connect.
Of course.
This is, it's a different vibe. I'm already feeling it coming in here to do this. But so it looked, you mentioned your teaching semester was, or quarter, I guess you guys are on quarters.
Yeah.
And I looked at your teaching and it looks like, is it like two grad classes on AI stuff? Is that what I saw?
Yeah, it's like a, it's, I teach this class on AI, which is, for MBAs, and then I teach this one PhD class, which is more of a kind of a seminar. We talk about the tools of research, but the MBA class is like two sections, and it's not it's like it's I put more work into this class than I put into any given project, just because if you look at the existing stuff out there that tries to communicate or teach AI, or even in the research literature, there's sort of a massive hole. And the way I would kind of describe it is, once something exists in the following format, there is a data set, and there is a outcome variable, and there's some features to use, or even some of the features, it could be large corpus of language, it could be a picture, it could be many pictures, it could be a movie, but something you're using to predict this thing, once that exists, that's really where everything starts. So like if you take a class on machine learning, what they are teaching you is machine learning once you have the data set. And if you look at research papers, they are machine learning given a data matrix. And then if you look at where all of the problems we're having with machine learning come from, they come from the following activity. Given some phenomena in the world, or some thing I would like to accomplish, or something I'd like to do, or something I'd like to understand, I have to take that and I have to assert this data set is going to represent that problem. If that makes any sense. And that translation from world into data, I kind of call it datafication, is where everything goes to hell. There are actually no problems once it's a data set, weirdly, like racial bias, algorithmic bias. I mean, yeah, you can turn around and say, oh, there's this, but by and large, for first approximation, everything happened in this pre-stage, but yet there's no science of this pre-stage. There's no teaching, like if you're a person who's going to be building these products, there's no teaching you what could go wrong at that stage. How should you even do it? What should you even look for? So this class is just a ton of work to even articulate what I'm articulating now in a crisp way. And then to say, here's what can, how you can do this stage well and badly, and what goes right and what goes wrong, and how you can build products. So I think it's weird that we're about to start applying AI at scale, even though this single big thing, architecting the problem, is not something that we currently have people who know how to do it.
Is that kind of saying that the machine learning stuff is detecting something in the data that is really just a reflection of what built the data, but we can't really go that layer below that? Is that kind of what you mean?
I think what I mean is, suppose I said to you, I want an algorithm that predicts the neighborhood where there's going to be crime. So there's an English statement of that. That's the problem. It's in my head. You know, given the psychology of articulation, I might not be, even in my own head, it might not be as clear as I think it is, but whatever. It's there in some nebulous problem conceptualization space. Then someone comes to me and says, I have a data set, each row is a neighborhood, the outcome is crime that year, here's all the things we know about these neighborhoods, I want you to, I've now built an algorithm that predicts that. What should you even think about as to whether that data set represents that problem in your head? So just to illustrate how hard that is, we use the word crime. So what is the variable here? Well, it's not quite crime, right? It's people who complained about crime. That's not crime. I mean, that's not what you thought it was. Already you start asking questions like, oh, well, what if in some neighborhoods people complain more? Like, the algorithm can never escape the box it's in. The box it's in, the world it lives in, is defined by the data it's working in. It has no capacity. So who could ever escape it? It can't even be the engineering team, because again, the engineering team works inside the box. They've been given the data set. Who is responsible for understanding whether whatever we thought we were trying to capture is actually has any fidelity? Like, and it's so weird. The reason this problem hasn't crept up like 10 years ago or 5 years ago is because these algorithms have largely been used in online contexts where the data is biggest. And there, the problem we care about and the thing that's the data are almost always the same. Like, I'm paid by clicks, I care about click. I paid by sales, I care about sales. Like, what do you mean, what do I care about? Like, that's the thing. So in these very highly metricized, where measurement is automatically happening, like when we've wired everything up, censored in these highly censored environments, there's no context. But when you leave that online world and you try and apply it anywhere else, these questions loom large. If people don't understand there's a gap, mm-hmm. and all this shit happens as a result. And so,
yeah, it strikes me as it's a construct validity issue in the Perfect. Language of research, right?
It's 100% right. It's a construct.
And validity. I always say, you know, I envy physical sciences who can say like, oh, well, my construct is that it's this cell. You go, there's no translation problem where I go, well, if you study happiness, you've got a whole mess before you can make sure that what you're testing is what you say you want to know.
That's exactly right. That's right. Think of it as, yeah, I love your way of putting it. It's exactly that. Imagine I told you every real world application of AI has to have somebody testing construct validity. You're like, what the hell? Even my PhD students don't know how to test construct validity. Right? I mean, that's just the reality. It's like most PhD students start with the measures that are already out there because I don't want to think about it. So, and if you dig into I spent some time digging into construct validity literature, and I don't mean to badmouth the construct validity literature, it's a hard problem. But when you dig into it, it's not like there's much there other than, you know, have a lot of people look at it, like make sure it makes sense to you.
Think face about
validity.
It.
Think about it. Yeah, exactly. Think about it. Face validity is one of the most beautiful phrases I've ever encountered because it sounds so nice. when you open it up, you're like, oh, I see. What a beautiful way of saying. Just make sure it makes sense.
Yeah. Right? But I don't know. Does it look fine? Right? If it looks like a duck.
yeah, there you go. Yeah, anyway. It's the peak of academic jargon. Like,
right.
Such a beautiful way of saying something that if you just strip it away, you're like, that's really what you're saying?
Right. Anyway. Saying a lot, but in a nice package. Very cool. Well, I know it's the evening, so I also want to be mindful of your time. I'm pretty happy to have a freewheeling kind of let's explore some stuff with the series. But I also, I mean, if you tell me like I got 20 minutes to give you, then that's what we'll do.
You should tell me what you would like to optimize. I mean, yeah, I'd love to hear what you work on. So whatever works for you, I'm happy.
Yeah, so I'll give you a little background on me and a little background on what we're working on in the bigger picture and then what I'm hoping to get from you. Mm-hmm. And we can see where that takes us. So my background, so you know, my Ball State affiliation. Beyond that, I'm a social psych guy. I study persuasion and attitude change and attitude strength and that world. And so, you know, so I started producing this podcast called Opinion Science a couple of years ago now. And the whole premise is, how do we understand people's opinions, where they come from, and how they change, right? And so I'm interested in talking to psychologists, communication folks, political scientists, and even folks like film critics and political campaign managers, polling folks. So that's kind of where I come at this from. And so there's another show out there called Behavioral Grooves, who they're very much in the business of behavioral science.
I was on one of their.
Ah, okay.
Well, no, wait. Was I on one of their?
I don't know that you have been.
Wait, maybe I haven't been on there, but somebody. Anyway, I had some connectivity. Maybe it's someone I knew was on there and asking questions. Or at least I've heard them. Yeah.
So they're out there. They're very behavioral science-y, targeting like applied insights. And so, you know, we kind of live in similar worlds, but not the same one. And we had connected a little bit. I had produced this kind of narrative episode on cognitive dissonance, which was like, let's kind of break down the story, talk to the characters, and sort of clarify, like, what is this construct that people think they know, but they clearly
don't. I remember what it is. I have this app that I helped co-found, and the CEO of it was on Behavioral Groups.
Gotcha. Okay. So they heard this
awesome
episode that I produced, and they had one of those guys knows George Loewenstein, and just casually Loewenstein mentioned this anecdote about where the word behavioral economics came from and like the room that that idea was hatched in, and he thought, oh well, we should do like the story of behavioral economics and where did it come from, what does it mean, and so we've kind of sketched out this kind of 5-part series looking at like, you know, early days of Thaler pushing back on assumptions, Kahneman and Tversky raising hell, economists and psychologists getting mad. And then now this point where it's hit sort of a mainstream semi-accepted state that it just sort of floats on its own. So where we're at now is you are probably the last person that we'll talk to for this, which is handy because we kind of know where we have some missing pieces. So there are kind of three general things that I think you could speak to. One is I had seen in Thaler's book that he calls you out as in the first cohort of the summer camp for behavioral economics. And that strikes me as an important part of the story. Like now this is a machine that's chugging along and people are hopping on board. And so where's this going? So I want to kind of get your experience as like a very young, bright-eyed student. And then also just kind of get you to muse on what behavioral economics is, what the parameters are that make something behavioral economics or not, et cetera. And then finally, if you'll indulge me, I didn't connect the dots until I was prepping to talk with you that you are on that paper from 20 years ago or so, the audit study on job discrimination.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I teach that constantly. I never put two and two together that was you. So I don't know that it'll end up in this series, but there is sort of
we can talk about whatever we want. Yeah.
Yeah, talk about it and share that. And it may sort of be its own little spin-off conversation.
Because
it strikes me that was a Herculean effort to actually pull off. So I think there's a story there too. So does that all sound good?
Sounds great to me,
cool? So if we kind of jump right in, my impression is that you connected with Thaler as an undergrad. Is that right?
Yep.
So what was that? Where did your paths cross?
Yeah, so I was an undergrad at Cornell when Thaler was there, and I had taken some econ classes. I think that the first thing that really woke me up to like, wow, I mean, I was a math undergrad. I did a lot of math. In fact, the first econ class I took was just a PhD micro class, and I was like, oh, this is like math. And I was like, a part of me was like, I guess it's just math. Or I don't know, like something just do like math. And so that seemed fine. But then I took this, and I was like, it's got to be more to it than that. So I took this very interesting class by Bob Frank. It was very eye-opening. And it, to this day, remains one of the best sort of taught classes I've ever been to. He had this exercise, which was just immensely valuable, where he would just say, well, the premise of the exercise is great, which is, look, if you're a botanist, a walk in the woods is a very different experience because you just see the world differently. If you're an economist / social scientist / psychologist, a walk in the world should be very different because after all, everything is flowers and leaves for you. And so his class was, how do I inculcate in people that sort of muscle to look at the world through these new eyes that I'm providing, rather than simply look at research papers through these new eyes I'm providing? And when you do that, it helps you understand the thing you're learning, but in turn, it helps you question the thing you're learning. So he had this really quite terrific way to do that, I think, just super powerful. And I'd love to see more people use it as a tool. So his way was try to, every week or 2 weeks, you would write an anomalies thing. You would try to find something in the world that appears to not fit what you're currently learning, or at least has some tension. And then you can resolve the tension. It may not really be an anomaly. So actually the reason this is happening is, and then you understand the idea at a deeper level because you realize the superficial application is failing, but actually a deeper. And now you've effectively created a conversation with tension between reality and the idea, and you are forced to resolve that tension. That's two pages. Now, Bob Frank listening to this might be thinking, that has nothing to do with what I actually assigned, but this is what I remember. So let's just assume this is what happened and not question what I'm saying. So that is an incredibly valuable exercise. It just was so interesting. He also taught in class some of the basic JDM stuff, heuristics biases, but that being taught that but being forced to do this was just so fun. And I think it really woke me up to the realization that if I'm going to do social science, and it wasn't clear to me that I was going to do economics or psychology, it wasn't clear to me I was going to do any of that. If I'm going to, I needed to do this, because if I'm just doing math, I'm just going to do math. Or at that time I was doing computer science theory, and I'm like, let's do CS theory or logic or math. But if I'm going to do social science, this is what I'm going to do, because this seemed interesting, because this is reality having a conversation with our preconceptions. So that was exciting. And then Thaler was teaching a PhD class, and I thought, oh, well, I'll try taking that. And I think it's fair to say that that is the class which had the most favorable teacher-to-student ratio I've ever seen in my life. I think there were three of us in that class, students, and there were three faculty, which you might think is one-to-one, but with, but I mean, you can imagine, it's a pretty heavy teaching load for them, so they had a bunch of guest lecturers on top of it. So this class was basically like, I mean, it was absurd. And it was just insane that they have three faculty, three students, and guest lecturers. Anyway, it was really interesting. And I think, I'm not sure what I remember of the class other than the faculty were just, I learned, like, most of, I think, what you learn when you're young is you get imprinted that this is a way to be a scholar. So like Kathleen Valley, I still remember her and how she thought, and Bob Gibbons, and Dick Thaler, Richard Thaler, right? Just, I just, you know, and so they really made a big impression on me. And I stayed very close touch with Thaler and to a degree Gibbons, but like definitely Thaler, because I became more interested in behavioral economics. And it had a big influence on me that, you know, I was like, this, I actually applied to a PhD in computer science and I deferred it for a year. And I said, I'll try economics out. And really what convinced me was that I was like, I think I would enjoy doing economics if I could do something like this stuff. Like, there wasn't really anyone doing it that I knew of. Matt Rabin came, so that was a little bit of a role model. But outside of that, there was like, you know, and David Lapson was still a grad student. So there was a few, couple of people, but it really, you know, wasn't anything. And then that, so that was point one. Point two, which you might find interesting, is Thaler was very vehement that I not do a behavioral economics in my PhD. Because he said it's really important that you are like considered like an actual economist with an actual field. I think I listened to him until the very end, where I was just stopped listening to him. And my job market paper was like a psychology paper. It was about human memory, but I did listen to him until then, and that proved to be very good advice. Maybe I should have listened all the way through, but I did go on the market as a behavioral economist. And maybe that was a mistake. I'm not sure, but his advice.
Why is that good advice? What was it about that was helpful?
You know, if you said to me, who understands the rational model best in the economics profession? List 10 people. You know, I'd put Thaler in that top 10. Like, it goes back to the Bob Frank story. You can't understand the flaws of something if you don't know what the thing is really well. So I think that's part of why it was very good advice. The other part of why it was very good advice is because behavioral, as a field, it doesn't have enough to equip you with tools at that time. So you need to get tools. And so like you do labor, you get tools of how to work with data. There's an element in grad school where you're really acquiring is tools and ways of thinking. And so in that sense, he was right. And the third sense he was right is that it was much easier for me to be a behavioral economist on the market when I knew I could talk to anyone who did empirical work and they'd be like, oh, he actually knows what he's doing. Talk to anyone who's doing theory and they're like, oh, he knows what he's doing. Somehow it's like China goes to Nixon. Like, it's just easier. Nixon goes to China. It's just like easier. I think those are the three reasons he said it. It's related to something. Maybe it's one of your later questions, but we might as well jump ahead now. Is that I really question why there's a field called behavioral economics. Like, I know Thaler does. I think he still does. It doesn't actually make sense. Like, shouldn't all economics be behavioral economics? And so what is this? Like, why is it? Like, if a student came to me now and said, I want to be a behavioral economist, I'm like, yeah, everybody, that's what you are. You're doing economics. So what do you want to work on? Like, what does that even? So I do worry that the existence of a field and the continued existence of a field called behavioral economics is a form of failure perpetuating, which we shouldn't perpetuate.
Do you think it had to be identified as a domain at the beginning, at least?
I think there's a period, this gets back to your summer school thing. One thing that's amazing about the summer school is that you know, groups need identities, like to feel like you get there, you're like, I'm not doing this, I don't know what I'm doing. And you show up like a lot of people are interested in this now, or like 30 people. And it's like 30 is a lot. Like when you think there's only two people, there's like a multifold, a bunch of them say, well, I wouldn't say I'm doing behavioral economics. So a bunch, you know, let's say half of them fell out, but the other half, they are like the leaders in this field. So it's like at that moment, you're like, we're all the people who went on to be leaders. But at the time, there was no field, there was nothing. And so you're definitely right that having some notion of kindred spirits makes a big difference. And an identity label definitely helps you. But at some level, you kind of need things where there's programmed cell death. And the identity label needs to have programmed cell death because, you know, at some point, the identity label becomes exclusionary. And we want everybody to think they're, quote, a behavioral economist. We want economics to be behavioral economics. So, you know, at some point, it has to disappear, I think.
Yeah, that is a dilemma where, you know, you need it to rally the troops, but then it ends up back. So how how could you plan for, like, okay, in 20 years, let's assume we've infiltrated the group. We've spread our ideas, and now we can abandon the name, and we can just integrate back into this group.
That's exactly right. And I think the integration phase is partly what we're in because, and that's the challenge that we're facing. Because there's a lot of good behavioral economics papers now that are being published. Most of them by people who don't call themselves behavioral economics economists, and that are published and not even thought of as behavioral economics papers, which is success. So why are we still producing these? So it's like, it's a tough question that we have to now ask a little bit. So I'm not even sure if you ask most people whether they would say I'm a behavioral economist now. I don't know. Like most of what I do integrate psychology, but why shouldn't, shouldn't all work in integrate psychology? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So, so I think that there's an element of, you're right. It's unclear how to do it.
I know that there's some frustration sometimes among psychologists who say, oh, we came across this economics paper from this year that discovered something that we published 20 years ago. And, you know, in some ways, that's a credit to this perspective has now kind of like gotten soaked up into the field of economics. But it also seems like it could be coming at the expense of giving credit to other fields from which those ideas are coming.
Absolutely. Without question. I think economists, even some behavioral economists, are shockingly underread about psychology. And they should be ashamed. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And I think it's because I'm not saying all are, many are well-read. Many, I mean, like George Zolotin, is he a behavioral economist or is he a psychologist? I mean, many are just like, not just well-read, but like published and do amazing things. But there is quite a few, and you see it especially in PhD students. And I think it comes from the following arrogance, really, which is that, well, I mean, psychologists ran their experiments, but it's without incentives and they didn't really think about the exact mechanism. And it's like, no, they thought about mechanism in the constructs they use. You have a different construct. That's fine. You might want to rerun it. But I mean, person in the situation was discovered, well, like a ton of rediscovery is just, it is absurd. If I were psychology, I would be like, this is absurd. Like super absurd.
So yeah, so one of the places I wanted to go was like, what is the relationship between behavioral economics and psychology? So if we stick on psychology, like if you were to reflect a little bit on, I mean, you kind of already have, but like what is the role of psychology in the development of behavioral economics?
Going forward, you mean?
Where we came from and where we're going.
Where we came from?
Yeah.
I mean, where we came from, I think the role of psychology is pretty clear, which is, and it really goes back to the playbook of Kahneman Tversky, which is there was a moment in history where psychology and you call it economics, it's basically axiomatic choice theory, intersected. That intersection allowed a very fruitful place for psychologists to say, your axioms are goofy, I will now show you. it gave a very clear baseline model, and the act of rejecting that model proved very generative. So if you look at a lot of papers in that period, they are actually playing off of the existence of this baseline model, if that makes sense. So you ever see these people in space, like astronauts or like whatever, if they want to go in this direction, they need something to push off of. You can't the lack of gravity makes very transparent Newton's, what is it, second law, like that you move through Newton's second law. The push is what lets you move like that. And with gravity, you don't notice it because walking is always a push generates momentum situation. I'm saying that because research is very often like this. People don't appreciate how something generative occurs because you have something to push against and off of in the other direction. The entirety, and therefore you also understand the bias it produces because your vector, it's a perverse relationship. See, if you say, oh, this rational choice model is wrong, I can show it, and it's very generative. You come up with the representative heuristic, all these beautiful heuristics. But the vector you're following is created by pushing off of the rational choice model. So it is also sort of limited. And so ultimately, that interface created this body of evidence. And then that body of evidence gave the ammunition needed for behavioral economists to be able to show people your models are mistaken. Then the sort of generation was let me take that body of evidence and try to incorporate it into some formal modeling is where a lot of the trouble began, because there's a lot of psychology. Mm-hmm. The idea of reductionism of the rich domain of the human, of the rich domain of the human mind to some like, so now there's tension. The tension being, I think most behavioral economists are looking for parsimonious models of human behavior / mind that are more realistic, parsimonious, that capture most everything. Like that's what you kind of want. Now, put on your psychologist hat, you'll be like, what are you even saying? Like to human, if you wrote down the greatest mysteries known to mankind, that you could go to any caveman or cavewoman and ask them, what is mysterious? You'd be like, the stars up there are mysterious, death is mysterious, and how I'm having this conversation is mysterious. Like, those are the three great mysteries of mankind. And you're going to tell me there's a little model that captures all of them? Like, it's like, what are you, crazy? So there is now a tension that's pretty palpable, if that makes sense. And it's why behavioral economists and psychologists don't really have many conversations, right? There aren't many places you go to where there's much interaction. And so that's partly why I'm not sure I call myself, like, I interact a lot with psychologists. I publish in psychology. I like psychology. Am I a behavioral economist? I don't know. I'm unclear. I'm not sure I buy into the idea that we're going to get a parsimonious model. I think we'll get parsimonious models that work, but not parsimonious models that are capturing big fractions of human behavior. I mean, how is that even possible? How could we hope for that? And maybe that's,
To the question of labels, what do you tell people you are?
I've given up trying. I don't know. I don't even know. Like, you know what's so funny? It's like, I often have this thing where I think about what the world was like before you had mirrors. You never knew what you look like. Isn't that interesting? But now we live in that world, just not for physical mirrors. But I don't know what labels people give me. I have no idea. Isn't that weird that people have written letters of recommendation for you?
Right.
They've given you labels, and they exist, and they're shared. Like if we polled all of your faculty colleagues, at Ball State, or your faculty colleagues at your conferences that you tend to go to, there's a shared set of labels they have. That's like your visage, but like the person in the 12th century who could never see their visage because the mirror didn't exist, you and I can't see those labels. Mm-hmm.
There's some cool work in neuroscience that's finding like the mental representations of me, for example, right? Like I have a bunch of, I was in one of these studies and saw the paper come out, and I was another thing where I thought, wait a minute. That's other amazing. People's mental representation of me is somehow in this figure.
That is amazing. That is really interesting.
Yeah, they took all the grad students in the social area at Ohio State, and we all sort of saw the names of our fellow students.
Oh my God, really?
I don't know if we evaluated them or something, but we were in the scanner, and they did something to say, like, is there overlap in the ways that people think amazing. About an individual person, right? And again, to your point, that's inaccessible to me, right? There is a me that lives in the brains of the people I know, but I'll never really know exactly what that is.
And that is not exactly. Yeah. And so I often feel a certain sense of loss in not having a label I can put on myself. I know there are people out there who like it. They're like, oh, but I don't know. I'd like to have a tribe. I mean, it would be nice to have, like, it would be really nice to be able to say, this is my people. Like, people will say things to me like, it's like, oh yeah, that's my conference. And I'm like, wow. So you go to this conference again and again, you see the same group of people. It's kind of fun. You look forward to it. You know each other. I'm like, I don't have anything like that. Like, you know, I'm just sitting here in my t-shirt, like, wondering what I'm going to do next. So yeah, I wish I had a label. I wish I either had a label or was one of those people who'd say things like, I'm a maverick. I like being a maverick. I've always enjoyed it. Like,
I have increasingly turned towards social science as the label. In my heart, I guess I'm a social psychologist, but any of the things I care about are incomplete without understanding it from these other angles. So to say a social scientist strikes me as it's enough to shut people up.
Yeah, that's right.
And to have something of a tribe.
I think that I asked you whether you wanted backward or forward. If I was looking forward, I think the central challenge facing social science right now in the next 30 years that it has to figure out is that the division of labor it has historically construed is not going to work going forward. The current division of labor that we have, one department that studies psychology, one department that studies the economy, one department, like, what? Doesn't make any sense. This is just a weird way to cut stuff up. And you're seeing this, like, you're seeing it methodologically. So, like, what is a well-trained social scientist in 2030 going to look like? They're obviously going to know experimental methods, lab experiments, field methods. They're obviously going to know survey design methods, because you can do some survey design collection, construct validity, things like that. They're obviously going to know machine learning, causal inference, observational causal inference. What field actually has a student teaching all of those? None. Okay, already you know there's a problem. Just from a pure methods point of view, the world we need to get to is not going to be accomplished with the current breakdown we have. And then you just walk down and you say, okay, suppose you have a student really interested in studying crime. Does it really make sense to segregate the students who do that with observational causal inference data in an economics department and the students who do that at the level of, you know, the psychology of criminal behavior, maybe in some, I don't know where that would fall in social psychology. It's kind of interesting because psychology doesn't like to take on applied things, but whatever, you can see then already there's a mismatch. Like, if I want to study the psychology of criminal behavior, you're saying I can't be a psychologist? Like, so there are all of these mismatches that are showing up in every discipline. So I see it with psychology, for example, which is that it doesn't have an easy way of thinking about people who have an applied area where that applied area isn't already considered psychology. So if my applied area is discrimination, great, you're a social psychologist. If my applied area is crime, it's like, why are you in a psych department? That sounds applied. Why don't you go to a policy school? What's between crime and I don't understand, but it's an arbitrary line. And so there's this like oddity that all these fields are just, we're all going to have to figure out how to just refactorize how we construct science, and it's going to be a fun 30 years, I guess.
So it raises a question. At first, I was thinking that sounds like the opposite of what behavioral economics had done, which was to sort of increasingly narrow to be like, okay, now we have to like carve out a. But then I wondered, you know, you could say that was the first step toward what you're talking about, that it's actually taking an integrative approach to say, like, neither of these alone are enough. And so what do you think? Those are two, I would say, qualitatively different perspectives on what behavioral economics is.
Some ideas are Trojan horses. I think that's where we are right now. I think a lot of people who are in behavioral economics, not all, maybe not even the majority, but a lot think in world one. No, we need to carve it down. No, we can't really use these psychological concepts unless they're like modeled. But what I think they're not appreciating is this stuff is a Trojan horse. Once it's in there, it's just gonna like you know, you've already accepted we're gonna look at the world with data. Wow, once you're looking at the world with data, it's not gonna comply with whatever attempts you're gonna do to try to keep it in the box. And let's even see how much worse it's gonna get. What constitutes data, machine learning is kind of transforming. Suddenly, corpuses of language data is data. So now we'll get even more puzzles. Oh, wow, people articulate. So the thing is just going to kind of explode out. I think your view too is right. It's not that anyone's going to accept the integrative approach. I'm sure most people listening to what I said earlier is like, this is goofy. This is the usual interdisciplinary crap. Yeah, it's fine. Sometimes it's just easier to think about the world as it kind of has to progress. Like once you accept this, once you see this is integrating, not integrating, but there's all of these signals coming in, how do you, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. Now it's like, oh, so to actually understand crime, what am I going to do? Blind myself to this kind of evidence and say, well, I don't care about that. I mean, you live in the world we live in. That evidence is going to come your way. And so it's almost like our machinery for producing data, whatever data is, and our opening the door to accepting the data and looking to see what it says, which is kind of what behavioral economics kind of was for kind of economics in some sense. There's no closing. It's like now more and more stuff is coming in and more will keep coming. And there's just no way to close it again. And I think that's what's going to force the action by then suddenly. You already see it with grad students. You already see that the most ambitious grad students are acquiring methods slightly outside their fields. That creates an arbitrage opportunity. More people are doing that. Okay, then suddenly. Like, and then just the thing unravels a little bit.
To sort of circle us back to somewhere that we were, but keep that thread alive. So if we go back to summer camp, if we mentally transport ourselves all those years ago, would you say that most of the, I guess, how would you characterize the people who were there? Were these all economists who were rabble rousers and let's push back? Or was it a complete mix of people from different
areas?
That's
what made it awesome. That's what made it super awesome. It's because you couldn't fill a class of 30 people with economists. So it was just a complete mix. There were junior faculty, there were faculty from marketing, faculty from psychology, I mean, it was just everywhere. And that also made it exciting because, you know, what happens, let's see, how do I say this without sounding like I'm some sort of postmodernist? Like every discipline has implicit rules as to what constitutes acceptable argument. So if you had a little lab experiment and I said, that's really interesting, but how do you make sense of the fact that the crime rate's been going up over the last 10 years? You'd be like, what? That's not an acceptable argument. Like every field only progresses by disallowing a set of things as acceptable arguments. For example, I can't in an econ seminar where someone puts up a model and I say, oh, but did you see that like the last 5 years there have been a bunch of like papers in psych science that showed blank? They'd be like, what? What do you go, weird? Why would I care? What is that? So we artificially constrain what constitutes acceptable as a confounder, as an argument. Like, and that's what is our almost, that's what I'm saying. I don't want to sound postmodern, but just having worked in so many fields, the first thing you have to do is to be like, what do these people consider like totally inbounds? So you can have in an economic seminar, that's an applied economic seminar, an absurdly long conversation of potential unobserved confounders that get really far down the rabbit hole and everyone's okay with that. They're like, oh yeah, there could be an unobservable one. People could do this and they could do that. And they're like, what's going on here? But that's because it's in the bounds of what's acceptable. But in that same seminar, I could never make an appeal to this piece of psychological evidence shows that it's not, that's not what we're here to do. We're here to kick the tires on whether you've gotten the causal inference right. So that the reason I'm saying that is because in Back to the Summer School, when you put people together from such different disciplines, what is the shared, like, what is the intersection of all of this? And most times when you put people together in that type of diverse group, nothing interesting happens because the intersection of what is considered a shared truth is zero. So conversations are about, oh, well, that's how your university works. Oh, it's really nice. What do you do for fun? Because you can't, it's very hard for three people from three disciplines to sit down and have a meeting, but it's just not possible. And I think you've been to some of these things. It's very hard unless you have a very exceptional group of three people or something or whatever. So somehow the summer school worked because the shared unit became all of the pockets of knowledge that different people had in different fields that, like, we didn't know. Like, oh, you have studies like that. Oh, that's really cool. Oh, you have that. So it became not about, like, what's right and wrong, but transferring little bits of knowledge, if that makes sense. And that's, so it was kind of like just the happiness of having found each other. It just became then just these sort of sharing. And that was really exciting. And that really made a lot of difference because I think everybody heard about things they hadn't heard about. It's the best way I describe it is, it's very, very easy in any job, even in our job where we're supposed to be at the frontier of knowledge, it's very easy for the world to feel small. Do you know what I mean? Like, the world feels small. It's like, everybody's like, yeah, I kind of know everything in this area. I kinda, it's like naive realism. It's like, well, this is the world. No, this is the few papers you're reading. Right. And when you're in this environment and you get these people with these other things, you're like, holy cow, the world is much bigger. I think I would hazard a guess to say everybody there had that experience of the world, by which we mean the research world, is much wider than we ever imagined. And that is exciting. Because, you know, when the world feels small, it all feels like a stupid game to climb to the top of something. Like, it's like, okay. When the world feels big, now it feels like exploration. And I think that was invigorating for a lot of people.
Like, you're actually studying the world, right? It's not, I'm in a literature. It's like, oh, no, this is, I can only see the thing when I see it from all of these angles. And I go, oh, right. That's what I'm studying.
Right. And you see your narrow-mindedness of yesterday. So when somebody says to you, like, I'll tell you one of my favorite studies. So this is a study where they ask people, how big is an elephant? And it's like, okay, this many pounds. Then they took the median answer to that, and they showed that to another group of people, and they ask, is an elephant bigger or smaller than this? And almost everyone agreed it was bigger than that. Now, I thought I understood anchoring. And I thought I understood sort of construal. But this simple experiment that whatever number I would give when I think an elephant is, when you ask me to solicit it, if you give it back to me, I will think it's bigger than that number. It's really eye-opening. And it made me realize, there's just something about the way we form judgments I didn't understand. So, like, I think people often think of, like, research studies as being exciting when they give answers. But, like, the exciting studies are the ones that open up and help you feel a little more ignorant. And I heard this study, and I'm like, oh, there is just something about judgment I don't understand. Because this study feels deeply true. Whatever number you give me, I kind of feel like an elephant must weigh more than that. Why? Because an elephant is big. Mm-hmm. You just gave me a number. There are bigger numbers. I don't know. And this study beautifully captures it, you know, because obviously, literally, my sense is not true. If you told me 1 billion tons, I'm like, obviously, an elephant. But there's a deep sense in which it's true. The study captures it. I hadn't realized it before. And now I'm like, oh, I'm actually ignorant about this. And I think that's what great research does, is it? Oh, and it's also what the original Kahneman-Tversky stuff did. Like, rational choice made you feel the world was small. This is how people decide. There are preference axioms. What would you expect? This is it. And then when someone cracks the door open and says, isn't this weird? You're like, oh my, yes, I am ignorant. I don't know how people choose. I don't know how people form judgments of probability. And it's kind of exciting. And I think the great papers really do that. They kind of open up your ignorance a little bit and make you curious. It's like, oh, I wonder what else is back there.
Okay, before I pivot to discrimination, just to be mindful of your time, any points that you haven't made about behavioral economics that you think are useful perspectives or things that sort of is sort of that this is your soapbox?
I think the one thing I'd say is that I'm a little concerned about the seeding of application by psychology to other disciplines. Because I think if you look at the early phases of social psychology, quote, application, like actually engaging with phenomena and the thing, was incredibly generative. Like Kurt Lewin, I mean, look at, like, if you looked at Kurt Lewin's productive output, a bunch of it was, quote, application. But it's not like he got his ideas by just sitting around and then he, quote, applied them. It's just such a faulty way to think about our interface with the world that our mind does all the work, then we go out and apply it. That's absurd. It's in the act of interacting with the world and wrestling with the world that we generate ideas that we then go back to the world. And there's more of a dynamic. And I'm concerned because I think psychology has an immense amount to contribute to nearly any phenomena that we as people care about. And I think that a deeper wrestling with that any phenomena in the world has a lot to contribute to deepening psychology. And I think that by not creating a better interface with application, maybe leaving it to economists, that's bad for the world, but I also think it's bad for psychology because I think it's part of what's generating this sort of like incentive to produce cute little effects that then like... putting aside replication, there's a level at which even if your cute effect reliably replicates, what am I supposed to do with a massive catalog of cute? It just doesn't, there's no end game there. And I think somehow psychology has to ask itself, like all of these pressing things, you know, people are not taking their medications and dying. Like, are we willing to put up with inequality? Or maybe it doesn't need to be that big. Maybe it needs to be everyday things. Like, I don't know. How do we think about work? Like, is what I'm doing with you right now at 7 p.m. work? Like, when I go to a restaurant in Europe, it's interesting to me that the waiter has a very different self-sense of worth than the same waiter if I go to a Applebee's in the U.S. Part of that is income, no doubt. But part of it is the waiter in Europe feels empowered to talk down to me. The Applebee's waiter feels like I'm their boss. How do you think about that phenomenon? I mean, there's already some psychology. But there's so much going on in the world that is just, and the world is ready for psychology, while psychology seems to be closing up doors and being like, well, if you're doing applied work, that's not for us. Like, what the hell? So I think that's the weird thing. I would hate to see psychology cede ground to economics.
Great. So I would love to talk about the audit study stuff, but if you want to...
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I have another 10 minutes. Yeah, let's go. Yeah,
cool. So if you could start by just sort of giving a sense of where this came from, right? Like it's sort of... My impression is that study spawned an industry of that type of research in a way that it wasn't really happening before then. Is that your sense? And if so, like, where else did it come from, if not the inspiration from predecessor?
Yeah, I think there was a very nice paper by Michael Gaddis that I was reading the other day. And I hate listening to myself on the radio or anything. And as most people do, I hate hearing my own voice. I hate reading what other people have to say about me. It's all very painful. But somehow I just like happen to stumble upon it. And I've often wondered why did that site generate all this? And I think he has an incredibly interesting explanation for why that study really generated. And so let me give you some background a little bit. The there were audit studies done before then, which were done by like sort of, you know, you'd recruit a bunch of auditors, hire people, train them, and they had methodological problems. How do you know that the black auditor was similar to the white auditor? But they're also just very, 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 very hard to pull off. And the thing that he says there was three reasons why this kind of paved the way for, like, as you say, an industry. And I think his first reason was, I think, the most compelling, which is it just showed a bunch of people that two random academics without much of a budget could do. And the whole thing costs like $10,000, $8,000, which is not nothing, but it is well, I mean, I bet you we spent as much on that as like a good psych lab at that time had spent on, you know, a couple of papers or one paper or two papers. So I think that's a lot of research is just about expanding people's conception of the possible. And I think his analysis is right. Oh, if those two people can do it, then certainly I could do it. And the thing that motivated us, though, ironically, was a person you should know very well, Richard Nisbett. And he has a terrific book that Marianne and I were reading, which is one of his less well-known books, The Culture of Honor. Beautiful book. Like, beautiful. If you want to think about somebody looking at one phenomenon, maybe a phenomenon you don't care about. I'm not even sure I cared about this phenomenon. But it's the culture of honor in the South. I guess I kind of care because you've seen it in movies. He looks at that from every angle. And one angle he looks at it was through the use of a very clever study design where he had people send in resumes and they had a letter in front. And the letter varied. And it said things like, I'm going to butcher it just like I butchered the Bob Frank thing. But let's just assume my memory of the Nisbett study is right. So one condition would say something like, I was in jail for this period, blah, blah, blah. I'm you know, some contriteness. The other one was a recourse to honor. I was in jail for this period because I caught my wife with cheating with a man. And as a man, I just couldn't let it. And he basically showed that in the South, the honor letter actually led to more callbacks. So anyway, so we'd read that and I loved it. Marianne loved it, but she's smarter than I am because she's like, why can't we use this design? I'm like, oh, interesting. What would you use it for? She's like, I don't know. Let's look for discrimination. She's like, oh, that's interesting. Didn't even think of that. And so then we thought about how would we use it to test for discrimination. And then kind of that's how we got into it. And then we matched back to these bigger audit studies, which we hadn't read, but we got back to it and said, oh, I see. People have tried this, but not with this minimum actually doable object. And that to me was very eye-opening because it made me realize, me too, that like we could do stuff in the world. It's not expensive. It's not hard. You just got to go do it. And so that spawned like my interest in RCTs and things like that.
So there was no interest in discrimination. That wasn't the beginning. It was more like, this is a method that seems cool.
Oh, no. Sorry. I often think of these things as like the way sexual reproduction works, like, you know, sexual reproduction requires two things. So we were reading Nisbett to generate, as we were doing, just to generate ideas. But one of the topics we've been really trying to figure out what to do something about was discrimination. So we had done a bunch of other matched discrimination to stuff that didn't work out, if that makes sense. So it's like often that's how I tend to try to be creative, which is there may be a thing I'm interested in that's like one part of sexual reproduction. But then I'm reading kind of broadly to find a mate for this thing so that they recombine to produce something else. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. You're sort of, treading both at the same time in the hopes that they're sort of the dual part comes together.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
And so, you know, the part that I'm curious about is actually like the physical work that you had to do this. Because nowadays, if I were to do that study and the audit studies now go, we're going to blast 1,000 emails to people and we'll sort of randomize the name on the top and we'll see what happens if people get emails back. But you did not, that was not what you did. So
no, it was like, I still had in my office, like this, I don't have it anymore, but like for a while, I still had up the faxing software that I had bought. Because I investigated a lot of the business of like, how would we get the resumes there? It's going to be painful to mail. Like initially we thought we'd mail, but it's like mailing is super painful. So then we bought like faxing software, which was at the cutting edge at the time, so that we could take the Word files and automatically fax. We had an RA, so they're like, where will they call? So we're like, oh, there's these companies that'll help us set up cheap fake lines. So we set up these fake phone lines. So you had to like set up this little operation, all of which was cheap, but it just required a certain entrepreneurialism to like figure out the faxing, like setting up the lines. And I remember the undergraduate research assistant who ran it. She's like, I feel like I'm running some sort of spy operation. And, you know, every morning they fax stuff out, they'd answer the phone calls and like see what emails had happened. And so a big part of this was exactly you say, the logistics. And I think the durable lesson for students today is that it's amazing how students, researchers get put off by not elbow grease. Everyone is hardworking. If I said, you have to do this, and you said, blah, 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 they'll do it. But put off by the unfamiliar part of it. Like, think of, like, it seems obvious when I tell you I have to get faxing software. But there is an unfamiliar part of it where I'm like, am I going to mail a fax? If I fax, what do I do? Is it fax machines? Now, even though you're a research, an assistant professor at some big university, you're like, okay, I guess now I have to learn how faxing is done. It has nothing to do with my research, apparently. But it was kind of fun. I spent 2 days like, okay, what are the options and where can I get this? And so I think people don't appreciate the value of that, if that makes sense. So I'll give you another example. People are always like, oh, I'd love to work on it, but I don't know how to get data. It's like, I don't know. Call up 10 companies, tell them you're a professor of blank, email them, and just see what happens. You'll have two people respond. You have two awkward meetings. Okay, it'll be fun, it'll be different. And so I think people are often just unwilling. Everyone's super hardworking, much more hardworking than I am. I'm lazy as hell, but people are a little bit afraid to like go into the unknown, logistical unknown, I guess I would think of it as.
And when you were pulling the ads from the classifieds, this was just, you get the paper and you looked?
Yeah. That's just got like yeah, you said it. Like it's exactly what you just said. And you can see why it feels awkward, because it feels like a logistical mess. But a lot of these things are that. Most things are not, like if I said to you, you're going to sit in front of the computer and type for hours and hours, you'd be like, what? If I said, oh, code this up, you're like, okay. Like the idea I want to go and get the paper, look at it, write it down, blah, blah, blah. That, seems weird, but it's only weird because it's unusual logistically. But and that everything you described was all what made that project hard was every step of the way I had to mentally repurpose myself. My dad and mom had a small business, and it was not by choice. I had like some economic issues showed up. So the first time they got the business, they bought it for $13,000, a video store. I still remember looking at the video store, and they put up shelves to hold the cases of the movies. Like they're these, used to be, people won't know this, but there used to be cases for movies, and you have to look at it because it has a name and the description. And I remember thinking, how the hell did my dad know where to get the particular shelves that would hold movie cases? This was definitely before internet. How'd you do that? I mean, that's entrepreneurialism. It's going into the logistical unknown of the most mundane things and being like, okay, I guess this is the problem I have to solve. I think people kind of forget that there is a big part of that in research is to do something creative. It's not about being creative in the mind. It's about having a willingness to push through in the world through the logistical unknown. And if you can do that, you can do lots of cool stuff.
Nice. The other, in terms of pushing through challenges, I was, in rereading the paper, I hadn't realized that September 11th happened in the middle of this enormous field experiment. Was that obviously your first reaction to 9/11 was everyone else's. Well, what was the moment that you thought, well, now hold on a second. We've been faxing out resumes for months now, or whatever it was. Like, what was that? I mean, was that a concern?
I'd like to say that I was so thoughtful, but no, not really. I mean, you're a junior faculty member. You're like, I don't want to say, I'm at the room experiment is run. You know, it's the flashbulb memory literature. it's 9/11 is very big in recall, and it feels to me like it was a big moment when it happened to me at the time. And it was a big moment. At one level, it was a big moment. But when life is being lived, it's not as big a moment in experience as it is in recall. I think that's like one of the reasons flashbulb memories are so bad, in that, of course, 9/11 was the biggest thing. George Bush was, and it's like the violence against people of Islamic, or people just looked Islamic, people who just looked weird. I mean, all of that was big. But still, there are 16 hours in my sleep, in my waking day, and most of my time was spent on the mundane, and 9/11 didn't penetrate most of the mundane. Does that make any sense? And mm-hmm. So it's like, how could you, someone could credibly say, listening to this, what kind of stupid person argue that the biggest thing that's happening is happening, and it didn't even occur to you that, why don't you add some Muslim names? I don't know. Maybe it occurred to Marianne. She's smarter than me, but it didn't. Like, and it's like life is lived in minutes and seconds, whereas these big things, they do cast shadows, but most of the little nooks and crannies of life aren't affected by most of the big shadows of living. Like, right, even think of the pandemic right now. Most of what's happening in your day-to-day life, even though the pandemic is the biggest thing that's affecting us psychologically and leading to a lot of dismay in people, there's just a lot of little moments in life. Like, most of my research projects, I'm not asking myself, how does the pandemic affect this? It's just somehow weirdly cordoned off from everything else.
And just to wrap up the discrimination thing, could you describe what the results of that were? And, you know, I'm interested, it's a huge effort. Were you pretty sure those were the results you were going to get? Or what part of it was surprising to you?
Absolutely not. So we did a bunch of interviews with HR managers just to understand, are we doing something reasonable, blah, blah. They all said, we're really glad you're running this study. You're going to find that if there's a qualified African-American, they will get called back at higher rates than whites. So I'm like, I know that's what you're going to find because we spend all our day scouring for qualified African-Americans. So I was like, oh, okay, we'll find evidence. I guess, I don't know. They were so certain they were going to find that. And I was like, I don't know, there's a lot of discrimination in the world. I truly had no idea. The one thing we were certain of was that whatever it was going to take a lot of power. And so we were going to run the study for about a year, I think. So we just had the whole machine run up and ready. And then at some point after like 2 months, we thought, well, let's just see where we are. And there was a huge effect difference of Black resumes being called back at much lower rates. So it was not at all, like we just didn't know given what all these people said. And we certainly didn't expect an effect size of 50% more callbacks for a white resume. Like we could have stopped this thing after like a month and there was an effect that was big enough. Like we were overpowered just because we didn't expect it. I mean, we just, back then, we didn't do power calculations either. So we just kind of let it run. And I think that effect size surprised us, that if just the reliability of the effect surprises. The two other things that surprised me are the two things from that paper that nobody, I learned one thing from that paper, which is that people remember one thing from papers. If you put a second and a third thing, doesn't matter, not going to remember that. So the second and the third thing that nobody remembers are, one, we did a very careful variation, but we didn't just manipulate race, we manipulated the skill of the resume. And in fact, for white people, more skill, more callbacks. For Black resumes, no difference. And that to me was striking, because that's not just discrimination. It means almost you stop reading once you see the person is Black. And in fact, there was a beautiful paper a few years ago that tracked how far people read in the field experiment. And they showed, in fact, people do literally stop reading. So that was beautiful.
If I can say, when I reread the paper, I underlined that result that you just said and wrote in the margin, wow, that there was zero effect of the resume quality. That was just so striking. And it's totally counter to what you were saying those HR managers would say. It was like, well, if it's highly qualified, if anything, you'll get a huge boost. And there you find, nope, people discount immediately.
Beautifully put. And in fact, maybe that's one reason I think we did the 2x2 design, because we're like, well, maybe let's... Who knows what we did, but you're exactly right. The other result, which is really surprised me, was nothing predicted the gap. We had a lot of sectoral variation. we did this thing where HR managers told us, oh, you know, one thing that really matters is we look at where people live. And you know, in places like in Chicago, you know, the zip codes that are like the poorer neighborhoods, the rougher neighborhoods, people kind of know that really well. And so we manipulated zip code, and that had like no mediating effect at all. So like a distinctively black name from a very rich zip code, like Lincoln Park, got the same treatment as a distinctively black name from a very poor neighborhood like the South Side of Chicago. And that was kind of surprising to me too, right? Given what the HR managers had told us. It's not as surprising as the other one, but I'm surprised at that.
Wow. Okay. You have been so generous, and this has been super fun too for me. So thanks for taking some time out of your evening. This has been super cool, and thanks.
Yeah, it's been a real delight talking to you.
Nice.
So I hope we can chat again soon.
Alrighty, that'll do it for another episode of Opinion Science. Big ol' thank you to Sendhil Molanathan for taking the time to wax philosophical on science and share his experiences doing impactful work that cuts across disciplines. As always, check out the show notes for a link to his website to learn more about what he's up to. You can follow this show by going to opinionsciencepodcast.com, where you'll find links to episodes, transcripts, and ways to get in touch with me. Follow or subscribe at any of the fine podcast purveyors that exist at the moment. And be sure to listen to our 5-part series on behavioral economics. Sendhil pops up in episodes 3 and 4. That series was called They Thought We Were Ridiculous, The Unlikely Story of Behavioral Economics. And you can find it on the Opinion Science podcast feed, or you can go to ridiculous-podcast.com. Shout out also, by the way, to David McCraney over at the show You Are Not So Smart for featuring our podcast series last week. That was super fun to do. Okay, that's all for me. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you in a couple weeks for more Opinion Science. Bye-bye.